This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. A recent study found that regular endurance exercise could trigger brain growth, and researchers at the Dana-Farber Medical Center at Harvard Medical School went on to suggest that this effect could be bottled as medicine that could help patients with early stage cognitive decline. So what is this all about? And, you know, do we all need to get started jogging now? With me today to discuss the matter is Professor Dr. Jeffrey Marlin Abdullah, neuroscientist, and Aaron Liddell, fitness expert and nutritionist. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Hello. How are you, listeners?
Thank you for having me.
So firstly, you know, Professor, what is neurogenesis?
Yeah. Neurogenesis comes from two words. You just break them into neuro, which is representing neurons or those very important cells in the brain that make you think. And genesis is formation. So this is a word that means formation or new formation of neurons or brain cells in our brain.
When is neurogenesis most active?
Okay. Studies have shown that neurogenesis starts when the baby is formed in utero, and it goes on until the median age of 17 years. So neurogenesis goes on and on. But there have been studies in animals, though, that indicate that neurogenesis is lifelong.
But not for us.
Not for all humans.
Okay. Yeah. Does brain growth, you know, does it vary in different stages of our life? So from infancy or in utero to 17, that's when it's most active.
Agreed.
But does it pop up from time to time again, or is it really sort of a steady decline after that?
Yeah, okay. The brain grows steadily until the age of 26. After the age of 26 years, on your 26th birthday, the brain will start to shrink. And it shrinks about 1% per annum. So you can calculate. And when you reach the age of 50 years, your brain shrinks about 1.5% per annum. And when you hit 70 years, your brain shrinks about 2% per annum.
So 26, 50, 70, those are the key ages we need to know.
From studies, yes.
Okay. And in which parts of the brain does neuron growth and actually loss primarily occur?
Yeah, okay. Studies have shown that neurogenesis and where neurons live and die means apoptosis, occurs in mainly two areas in the brain. One is in the hippocampus, and the other one is in the ventricle. There is an area in the brain which contains water, or cerebrospinal fluid, and under this layer of cells that produce water is a vast array of cells that are very actively involved in neurogenesis.
Do we know what causes the loss of brain cells? I mean, we're all told, you know, you hit a soccer ball one too many times and that's going to cause, you know, all these problems. But realistically, what is it?
Yes. It's said that every cell has its own half-life, and neurons have also its half-life. So nobody exactly knows how long a neuron can last. A neuron that you're born with or you are in utero can last theoretically up to the age of 80, but there are certain neurons in certain parts of the body, like in the hippocampus, that dies off after a period of 20 years or so, and regeneration has to occur.
So why is neurogenesis important? I mean, it seems self-explanatory, but from a scientific perspective, what role does it play?
Okay. If the neurons don't regenerate or are not retaken up again into those areas where the neurons do not function properly, then the person would have a problem with learning and memory. And later on, maybe problems with movement and problems in feeling, hearing and talking.
What's the difference between neurogenesis and neuroplasticity?
Yeah, okay. That's an easy question. Neurogenesis is the formation of new neurons, which is important. And plasticity is when, you know, the neurons have little foots at the end of these neurons, and they are called synapse. And when you have synaptic involvement, new synaptic movement involvement and old synaptic involvement, you will, and these changes after stroke or because your head hit a football, for example, or because you had a migraine attack, then the chance for recovery is there because plasticity is very important for recovery.
So having said that, are there mental exercises that we can do to stimulate neuron growth? I mean, here we're going to be looking shortly at fitness, physical fitness, but just within our brains, you know, there are all these little exercises that we're told to do, like counting cards, you know, things like that. Do they really contribute?
Yeah, they are. I mean, our scientists are quite smart people. So they have researched and found that there are certain components of mental exercises like attention, focus, memory, mathematics, for example, which are quite important for mental exercises.
And what specifically, what specific mental exercises would you recommend for people to do?
I think most important is mathematics. It's a very important mental exercise, which you should do until the age of 70 to 80.
I can hear people groaning, you know, all over Malaysia, forcing them to do math.
Yes.
Having said, you know, having discussed mental exercises, then how does physical exercise contribute to neurogenesis?
Okay, there have been studies, I think, since the 1990s, early 1990s, till today, 2013. There have been at least 21 studies on this, and all studies have shown that exercise, whether it is aerobic in nature, stretching, walking, jumping, does contribute to new neuron formation, and this is proven by carbon dating studies, by animal studies, and also by MRI human studies.
Aaron, when you got interested in in fitness and the science of it, were you interested in this component of it as well?
To be honest, I first got into fitness and nutrition and health about 8 or 9 years ago while I was still in school. And I was not aware of neurogenesis until about last week. It's pretty new. It's very interesting, but purely for having been a personal trainer, endurance training, fitness training, any sort, is usually about physical changes, health, aesthetics. But brain growth, it's new to me, but it's very interesting.
Considering, you do what you do, I'm not sure there's ever been a period in your life where you were completely sedentary, but when you exercise, do you notice an increase in your own mental acuity, or, you know, is it just... Or are you more focused on physical health?
Well, I used to be sedentary. I was overweight as a child, which spurred on the career of today. I think when you habitually engage in exercise, you find mental clarity either through avoiding a toxic lifestyle, through fast food and educating yourself on healthy eating, and stay away from alcohol, which gets you pretty foggy in the head. But apart from that, I had no understanding of brain growth through exercise. But
that's what we have Professor Jeffrey here for.
Thank you.
I'm speaking today to Professor Dr. Jeffrey Malin Abdullah. He's a neuroscientist, and Aaron Liddell, fitness expert and nutritionist. We're talking about a recent study that suggests that found that regular endurance exercise could trigger brain growth. If you have questions for us, do text. The number is 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio. So, Professor, this recent study, let's kind of hone in. They found that physical exercise stimulates the production of a protein called FNDC5. What exactly is that?
Yeah, okay. FNDC5 is a myokine, is a protein that comes from skeletal muscles. So FNDC5 is present in humans and also in animals. So as one does exercises, the skeletal muscle produces these myokines. These myokines go into the bloodstream, and then it goes through into the brain and stimulates another protein called BDNF, which is the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and also another protein called neurogrowth factor. And this then stimulates the neurons in your brain.
And when you say it like that, you know, it sounds like a very easy and obvious chain of events. This produces this, this produces this. Is this always how it is? Or, you know, are there kinks in the chain or a certain amount you need to be doing?
Yeah. I hate to throw this cool water over the fire, but this is the study that you quoted from Harvard Medical School. There was a study done early last year, which looked into the same protein, the FNDC5, in humans. Because the Harvard study was done in rodents, in rats, and they found that FNDC5 did not contribute to increased learning and memory in humans. It was some other protein. So there is a protein there that does improve learning and memory, but it is not the FNDC5 in humans.
We have a question from a listener named Chan. It's slightly off topic, but he says, "Doctor, my wife fell and hit her forehead on the floor and injured her trigeminal nerve. Is that
Yep.
She's on nerve medication. Can her damaged nerves regrow, and can anything be done to stop the nerve prickly pain? Thank you.
Okay. So that's what we call the word neurogenesis and plasticity. So one has to look at the structure of the nerve, whether it's intact or not. So you have to do certain imaging like MRI. To look whether the nerve is broken or not broken at certain places. And you can do an electrophysiology test to look if the whole nerve is normal or not. So those are tests you have to do in the hospital.
And are there any options aside from medication, or is it something that, you know, they'll have to see after the imaging?
Well, acupuncture works sometimes. So one could go back to good old acupuncture instead of drugs.
I'm speaking today to Professor Dr. Jeffrey Malin Abdullah, neuroscientist, and Aaron Liddell, fitness expert and nutritionist. We're talking about a recent study that found that regular endurance exercise could trigger brain growth. Dr. Jeffrey's kind of thrown cold water over it slightly, but still, we'll be addressing the links between exercise and brain growth. If you have questions, again, the number to text is 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me today, Professor Dr. Jeffrey Malin Abdullah, neuroscientist, and Aaron Liddell, fitness expert and nutritionist. And we're talking about the links between endurance exercise and brain growth. If you have questions, the number to text 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio. So just before we took that break, Professor, you were talking about how this study is flawed simply because it was conducted in rats, whereas a similar study conducted in humans yielded no results at all.
Correct.
Why exactly is that?
Yes, because we're looking at this wonderful protein called FNDC5. The same protein that exists in the rat or rodents and the same protein that exists in humans have different structures, even though they're called by the same name. And their genetic expression is also different in these two different, we are Homo sapiens and these are rodents, and these two proteins have even different chromosomal activities.
So have there been any links established between endurance exercise and brain growth?
Yes, those are quite classical. Forget about this protein FNDC5, which is no more the hero of this talk, I think. But there are many other proteins, unknown, some unknown, which actually improves learning and memory via exercise.
Aaron, you know, we're using the word endurance today. Mm-hmm. Could you clear that up for us? What exactly is endurance training?
Okay, so if we take in training as a whole, let's just take for, you know, your everyday gym goer or fitness enthusiast. So you've got different forms of training from flexibility up to, you know, strength and conditioning, and then endurance training, which is what we're focusing on. It's basically the act of exercising to increase stamina and endurance, hence the name. The term endurance training generally refers to the training of the aerobic system as opposed to the anaerobic system.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what are some examples of endurance training?
Of the exercise types?
Yes.
Well, it depends on the person, really. I mean, if you take a sedentary individual, first of all, the time of exercise is important to maintain elevated heart rate, which is what I believe is the important factor in the neurogenesis here. So you can have anything from walking, jogging, swimming, or even sexual activity, which can raise the heart rate, hopefully for an extended period of time. Anything up to the more advanced trainer where you take more professional cycling or running, for example. But anything really, there doesn't have to be any specific equipment or gym membership. As long as the heart rate is maintained at a higher level for a recommended 30 minutes a day or an hour a day, three times a week, roughly, you're on the right track.
Aside from neurogenesis, what bodily functions and organs are improved via endurance training? We talked about stamina, endurance. I mean, how is that reflected in the body?
Okay, well, firstly, cardiovascular adaptations will occur. For example, decreased heart rate, especially upon rest, due to a more efficient heart, increased stroke volume of the heart as well, where each pump pumps more blood through the body, increased blood plasma without any major changes in red blood cell count, which reduces blood viscosity and increased cardiac output as well. So those three factors all just make the heart more efficient, as well as what's quite interesting is mitochondrial volume increases in the muscle fibers used for the exercise. So if you take a cyclist, the mitochondrial volume in the cells of the muscles in their legs, for example, increase, and they become more efficient at creating energy. So it's easier for them to undergo the exercise over time.
Which is why practice makes perfect, essentially.
Essentially, with the generic task of carrying out the movements, whereas skill would be a different part of the training.
Going back to the sedentary people who live a sedentary lifestyle, because they're the ones who interest me in for the sake of this talk, simply because I'm always interested in how trainers kind of get people off their couches, because that seems to be the big first step, getting off and moving. So as somebody who works in the field, what's your process to get people to exercise?
Usually through motivational talks with them, or getting them to see the light, or whatever you want to say, just to get them kick-started. And then it can be anything from, for example, this information where you can, stop your brain from disintegrating over time to an extent through exercise. It's very interesting. So hopefully it isn't put in a bottle and pilled up for the population. But once they get going and they see some results, it's pretty easy to keep them habitually active. But yeah, the first bit is getting them off the couch, as you say, is the hard part.
How would you suggest somebody who isn't much of a fitness buff kind of get started on creating a program for themselves once they've started taking, those first initial walks around the park?
Yeah. The best recommendation is to find an accredited personal trainer, for example, or fitness trainer, boot camps, anything, which cater to all spectrums of fitness levels, and go from there. Fitness professionals will take every aspect of your life, any joint injuries, anything, and create a program for you specifically tailored to progress through to become fitter and increase endurance or whatever your goal is, fat loss, for example.
And you obviously mentioned the idea of these proteins being able to get pilled up, or rather to be transformed into prescription medicine. Professor, the same people, the same researchers did suggest that perhaps they could isolate, FNDC5 and put it into a pill and be able to administer that to people who need it, or to people who, as a preventive measure.
Yes. What
would this involve? What would the science behind this be?
Yeah, okay.
So let's pretend we're not talking about FNDC5, but another protein.
Yeah, okay. Let's say if we look at any protein, whether it is natural protein or synthetic protein or artificial protein, we would want to look at its structure, and we would want to look at the molecular weight of this protein. Can it be swallowed like a tablet? Has it got to be injected? Because it has to go to the brain. So it cannot be swallowed, because your digestive enzymes will digest your proteins like eating a piece of meat, and you come out the other end. So you will need to inject that into your body, just like male hormones or something like that, or snort it up your nose, or stick it right straight into the brain, for example. So, but I've read the literature, because these proteins have also side effects. So these proteins can cause one to be delusional. They can make people become drug addicts. So these proteins are not without their side effects.
When you say cause people to become drug addicts, do you mean addicted to the rush of the protein? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Something like that, yes.
Right. So if that being the case, would the intake of pills or supplements instead of endurance exercises ever be advisable?
I would say no, but exercise is very important, because after the age of 40, the brain over 10 years will shrink between 2-5%. And just by doing consistent exercises for a duration of 1 year, you will regain back that 5% you have lost over the last 10 years. So that's why exercise is so important. Better than medication.
Especially medication that you'd have to inject directly into the brain. Aaron, on that point, so we've talked about why endurance exercises are good, what spectrum they fall between. Let's talk about, and as well as how you can kind of get started. Are there specific types of equipment required to carry out certain endurance exercises for maximum efficacy?
Well, it depends. Well, firstly, you can take a number of factors such as budget or maybe a sport you might be interested in, for example. But I guess the most basic form could be brisk walking. So if we take, once again, a sedentary individual, even a light walk can be endurance training for some, especially in a country like this. It's very hot, so that also gets your heart rate up. But, the only equipment you need there is some comfortable training shoes, whereas you can go all the way up to, like, a 50,000 ringgit, you know, road bike and go and ride to KLIA and back. That's the spectrum there. So if you're looking to do it cheap and easy and privately, you know, you don't have to go to classes, you don't have to do that. You can just start walking every day for as much as you can, really. I mean, we've got busy lives, but if you can incorporate walking or...
The 10,000 steps.
Yeah, basically. That's it can be very helpful. And then maybe move on to a equipment-based sport where you can get a bit more physical, or even running, jogging. I personally like cycling, as there's less damage to the joints compared to jogging or running.
What I'm hearing from you is, I guess, the idea that endurance exercise could really be anything, but it depends quite a lot on your existing fitness level.
Yeah.
So how do you go about identifying that fitness level? Because somebody who doesn't go in for organized sports or organized training might still be relatively fit, whereas a thin sedentary person might, you know, not be fit at all. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a classic example. Well, I guess you just have to go out and, you know, test the waters, see how fit you are. You can either do that through a professional or just, you know, go for a brisk walk, see how you feel. And if there's any sort of sport or exercise mode that interests you, that's going to be the most important thing, because if it's not interesting, you're not going to do it. So you've got to stay enthusiastic about what you're doing. That's the most important thing. So if you love cycling or swimming, go for a swim or buy a bike or go to a gym and do it indoors so you don't get hit by a truck or something.
So identifying your initial fitness levels and then deciding what to do and then doing what is fun, I suppose, is a pretty neat way of, you know, getting towards your goals.
Yeah. So, I mean, for example, I like to do a lot of weekend activities like paintballing or weightboarding, where you forget about the exercise aspect and you spent 2 or 3 hours exercising and you're having fun. Having fun is the most important thing when it comes to getting someone into fitness, I think.
Professor, we have a question here. Is there any drug that can be developed to forget certain memories? You know, for example, since we know how to generate and develop neurons, can we also numb or delete particular neurons?
Yeah, there have been a few publications recently, early this year, also from the United States of America, where they're looking at certain proteins that you can block to delete memories. And this has happened in animals. Again, everything has been successful in our good old rodent, the rat, but we have yet to find this specific protein in humans.
So we've established also, what your take is on this particular piece of research. Although exercise and brain growth are linked, I suppose FNDC5 for us is not going to be of much help. Moving on, though, how does the stimulation of neurogenesis help with mental disorders such as Alzheimer's? Because obviously when we're talking about medication, these are the groups of people that we're particularly thinking
yes.
of.
So the studies have shown that from the age of 26, all normal, healthy human beings, regardless whether they are male or female, will have brain shrinkage up to 1% per year. So, the brain shrinks because there are two little receptors. One is called CREB, and the other one is called synapsin 1. This shrinks when we don't do exercise. So when we exercise, these two receptors will bloat up the neuronal cell, therefore increasing learning and memory. So aerobic exercise. And recently what I read was Tai Chi. There's a study done in Shanghai and in Miami where Tai Chi has helped improve learning and memory.
I have a question for you, Doctor. it's just come to my mind. We're talking about aerobic exercise increasing neurogenesis in the brain. But Would an exercise with a high level of skill, like maybe Tai Chi or martial art, which involves, you know,
thinking,
learning movements, be more beneficial than just sitting on a, you know, running on a treadmill for an hour?
Yes. This study in Shanghai and Miami were done only with people ages 70 years and above. So I think the exercise that would be different for those between maybe 26 and 50 or 26 and 70. So for those who have arthritis, who have problems in mobility, maybe Tai Chi or a Tai Chi-like exercise would be more relevant.
A question for the both of you. How important is it to be doing new things? I mean, both from a general perspective, you know, to be constantly learning, as well as, you know, from a physical perspective, to always be doing new things with your body.
Yes. May I take that question first?
Yeah, for
okay. Studies have been done, and this have been done both in healthy humans and in patients with dementia. Doing new things stimulate your BDNF, the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which makes your neuronal cells become bigger, and that indirectly improves learning and memory. And doing these new things constantly for about a year will make you regain what you have lost over the last 5 years.
So when we talk about new things, it can be anything from mentally challenging to physically challenging.
Agreed.
Yeah. So, well, personally, I like to have the old saying, you know, try something new every day. Make yourself uncomfortable. Then you do the thing and you become good at it. Then it becomes normal. So from a not such a scientific point of view, I would say, you know, try and do something new as often as you can.
Shocking the body is quite important for fitness, is it not? I mean, just to kind of get you out of plateaus and out of comfort zones.
Absolutely. Also, just mentally for confidence. Try and do something that scares you and get used to it. Better yourself.
Back to you, Professor. You know, while we're talking about Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and things of that nature, with this study, what they were interested in was the idea of being able to arrest the disease in early days of cognitive decline. I mean, every time we discuss these diseases, the idea of the early days, you know, come up time and time again. How much can really be done at this stage, and how do you define early?
Yes. I think from all the studies, I can summarize that with proof from MRI studies, that early starts at the age of 26. That is how early the fMRI studies have been done. So from the age of 26 onwards, it could be earlier, you know, but science has proven from the age of 26, the brain shrinks. So as we do mental exercises and physical exercises, I think we will then maintain the brain volume to at least the age of 70 or 76. And after the age of 76, I think it could be a little bit difficult to do all these exercises and maintain brain volume because the natural phenomenon of shrinkage will occur.
Mm.
And overall, why is brain fitness important?
Okay. Brain fitness is important at whatever age. Even at the age of 2 years, you know, till the age of 85, because it promotes, number one, neurogenesis, number two, plasticity. And there is a whole science called connectivity, where one can transfer learning and memory from one side of the brain, the right brain to the left brain, and the left brain to the right brain. And exercise is so important for this.
Moving on to other things aside from fitness, but that will still fall within your purview, I think. Does one's eating habits affect one's brain cell growth? I guess this is a question for the both of you.
From my understanding, healthy fat intake, so EFAs, essential fatty acids, can, they do repair cell membranes, also with a reduction in sugar intake, which damages them. That's my understanding. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Unhealthy food will decrease the number of these proteins called BDNF, and this will then cause the neuronal cells to shrink, and as they shrink, they will lose the ability to learn and memorize. So that's why healthy food is so important to maintain the size of our neurons.
And when we say things like essential fatty acids, you know, which are most beneficial? Because I think people tend to get very confused about the omegas, you know, the threes and the sixes and, you know, this and that, the other.
Yes. Well, maybe you answer that question first, then I can add on more scientific depressing facts.
Yeah, I'll go with the easy stuff, I guess. All right, so essential fatty acids that you want to really look for. So if we take omega-3, which has been proven to help a plethora of organs and parts of the body, eyes, skin, brain, everything, the best forms you're going to find are in cold-pressed seed oil, so they're not damaged. Krill oil is always a good option. And then it sort of deteriorates through the processing, the heat processes and that sort of thing, down to the poorly extracted fish oils, which you find in most of your supplement shops. But yeah, the best ones are cod liver oil, krill oil, and cold-pressed seed oils.
So my depressing statement, it comes from a very recent publication from United Kingdom,
yeah,
where a cardiologist discovered that eating fatty food is good for your heart and good for your brain. What is more important while you're eating this fatty food, you must exercise. So it's exercise is more important than the food.
Mm. Also, with eating the fatty food, so whole eggs, grass-fed steaks, which, you know, you must avoid grain, but that's a different conversation, that sort of thing, they provide these essential fatty acids from a natural source rather than an extracted source. So what he's mentioning is, you know, good, healthy fats, which is good for testosterone in men, good for cell repair. But if the bigger problem is sugar intake, which damages cells and it creates fat storage, especially visceral fat around the organs and cholesterol deposits in the bloodstream and that sort of thing. So it's more reducing sugar and increasing your healthy fat intake.
So sugar is the enemy, essential fatty acids are your friend, and exercise is your best friend.
Agreed.
Yeah?
There we go,
that's the hierarchy? Okay. Finally, you know, apart from exercise, sleep is said to be important for brain cell growth. How much sleep or rest should one get ideally for optimal neurogenesis?
Yes. Again, studies have shown in humans that one has to sleep adequately between 6 to 8 hours for a normal human being for us to maintain a normal BDNF level so as the cells can stay, the neurons can stay healthy.
And, you know, from your perspective, Aaron, how important is sleep to our health?
Well, sleep affects, healthy, uninterrupted sleep affects many factors of our lives. I mean, if you know when you've had a good night's sleep and you wake up, you feel fresh rather than you're fighting the snooze button on your phone or your alarm clock when you've only slept for 4 or 5 hours. Personal experience, anything under 6 hours and I'm pretty much useless for the next day. So 8 hours of sleep, uninterrupted, good deep REM sleep helps repair all the cells in the body. Sleep is when the cells repair. Daytime is when they break down and you're active. So you've got catabolism and anabolism. Anabolism is the repair. Catabolism is the breakdown. So the balance needs to be positive. And at night is when the fat, the healthy fats we previously mentioned, are utilized to create cellular repair and ensure good energy for the next day.
And you need to repay your sleep debt, I think, all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Doctor, a question. Do you think stem cells, orally ingested, not injected, can help in regenesis of damaged nerves?
Okay. The problem with stem cell sciences today is there are many types of cells. There are at least five different types of cells in the brain. And to just inject stem cells into one's brain and hope that these cells turn into those cells that we want them to become and to lie in a certain position would be quite interesting to see. And at the moment, we have not seen it yet. Whether it has happened in animals or humans, those phenomena does not exist currently. So it's still a fallacy and a fantasy.
All right. My final question to you both. What message would you like to leave us with on the subject of the links between exercise and brain growth?
Okay. My message is from those between the age of 26, maybe, or I like the number 26, till the age of 70, if you have your fit, you don't have osteoarthritis, maybe go for aerobic exercises. And for those 20 and above, or those who are immobile or may have limited mobility, light exercises like, you know, the Chinese Tai Chi is also one good example. So for us to improve our mental endurance.
Well, coming from the fitness industry, I'd encourage everybody to, if unsure, have a quick look over your weekly lifestyle and see how you're getting on with your daily activity, you might find that you're waking up, getting in your car, getting out, walking up to your office, and that's where you spend most of the day. You go home, and
you might be lucky. You know, you're assuming people walk to their office.
Well,
some people just take the lift. Yeah, exactly.
Have a look at yourself and take 5 minutes to analyze your activity per week. Honestly, just try and be as active as possible, because it is very beneficial to many aspects of the physical body, and now, as we know, the brain.
Thank you both for joining me today. I've been speaking to Professor Dr. Jeffrey Marlin Abdullah, neuroscientist, and Aaron Liddell, fitness expert and nutritionist. We've been discussing the links between exercise and brain growth. If it's not FNDC5, it's still good news. You still get all the benefits on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.